By becoming dean of the Bernard Revival Graduate School, I lost much of my credibility in discussing this topic because I've become an ogei avadover, and people will say, I always taught this, but you teach this in a college, you have tenure, you're not going to lose your job. But now I'm supposed to be running a school that deals with academic Jewish studies. So if I try to sell the importance of academic Jewish studies as an ideological matter, this is a self-interested enterprise. So you will have to apply the appropriate discount to whatever I say. Now, one of the interesting issues in defining the place of academic Jewish studies, specifically in the ideology of Torah Umada, is itself, I think, very interesting. There are people who see Torah Umada as the study of Torah and the study of general subjects, whether it's the sciences or it's humanities, within the same institutional setting, or within the same individual's intellectual profile, and ideally with some efforts to integrate them. And in that kind of perception, the role of academic Jewish studies is marginalized. Arguably, it can be ignored. However, for someone who takes the ideology of Torah Umada, even as formulated as I just did, seriously, it means that there is both intellectual and religious value in pursuing various academic disciplines because they presumably have something to offer in enriching one's understanding and perhaps even in disciplining one's modes of thought. Now, if that's true, then the value of this sort of disciplinary approach, this mode of thinking to Judaism appears to be self-evident and really ineluctable, so that one who takes this ideology seriously must, I think, take seriously the possibility, at least, that applying it to the study of Judaism is important and even in an ideal sense, essential. Obviously, I think that that's true. And what I want to do today is discuss how the academic study of Judaism, either because of its intrinsic character or because of the practical way in which it is pursued, compared with the practical way in which the study of Torah in other modes is pursued, makes the pursuit of academic Jewish studies religiously desirable. But this will not just be a polemic. I will try to illustrate these things in ways that I think reflect themselves a kind of more or less academically respectable and somewhat objective manner or approach. Now, when you look at the relevance of the study, the academic study of Jewish subjects, and in my case, I'm a historian, and so history is the area that I gravitate toward. And you ask what the role is of this kind of approach, of the study, say, of Jewish history to begin with, in Judaism. I think there's a certain salutary effect in asking ourselves first how the study of Jewish history intersects with Judaism in non-Orthodox religious movements. And there, at least in theory, the study of history actually is central to how Judaism is defined I was once present at an event at the Jewish Theological Seminary where Gerson Cohen, who was then its chancellor, and who was my teacher in Jewish history when I was in Columbia Graduate School, before he moved to the seminary, said the following sentence. The study of history is Torah as we understand it. Now, this is not something any Orthodox Jew can say. Certainly not something any Orthodox Jew should say. The argument essentially is that through the understanding of how Judaism developed over the centuries, one understands its presumed essence, what is important in it, what can be dispensed with, and how we should continue to bring about its evolution. And even institutionally, academics play a kind of ironically powerful role in those other movements. I once illustrated this with an account of, or just reminding people of an issue that is now at the center of Orthodox discourse, but was then at the center of conservative discourse. And that was whether women should be allowed into the rabbinical program at the Jewish Theological Seminary. Now, that is a religious question for a religious movement, right? I mean, you can't have a more clearly religious decision. But the question was being voted on in the context of admitting women to a program in an academic institution. And therefore, the people who had a vote on this question, and I'm oversimplifying because there were other elements in this process, but the people who had the vote on this question were the professors at the Jewish Theological Seminary, to the point where someone told me an anecdote which is, I will say right away, not entirely fair to conservative Judaism, but this is supposed to have been a real exchange. Professor at the seminary, who was really pretty much Orthodox, was approached by another professor the day of the vote and said that you have no right to vote on this question because you're not even a conservative Jew. To which the addressee thought for a moment and replied, how do you prove that you're a conservative Jew? If someone asks you to prove that you're an Orthodox Jew, what do you say? You point to your mitzvahs. So how do you prove you're a conservative Jew? By pointing to your Averis? Now, there is an uncomfortable amount of validity in this response, because that's really what he was being asked to do, almost. And I repeat, it's not altogether fair. But the real point of this is that this person's qualifications to decide a fundamental question of religion in the conservative movement was a function of his academic standing. That was his credential. It wasn't one way or the other whether he was a conservative Jew. And while this is an extreme sort of almost technical illustration, it does indicate, it illuminates the centrality, at least in theory, and in this case even to some degree in practice, of academics to religion. In conservative Judaism, and in Reform Judaism, it's a little more complicated, but it's not that different. In Orthodoxy, the situation is much more complex and, I think, much more interesting. What does the academic study of Judaism contribute to the understanding of Judaism from a religious perspective? What does it do that the traditional study of Torah does not accomplish in itself? And is that worthwhile? First, we have to see what these things are. There are many answers to these to this question. Some of them intrinsic to the discipline or to the mode of study, and some almost accidental, but nonetheless very important. Let me begin with what I've called accidental. I mean, that's not really the right word. As Torah is studied traditionally in yeshivos, including in the yeshiva part of YU, there are large areas of Torah that are just not studied, forgetting about the approach to the study of the material, forgetting about academic methodology or whatever you want to call it, simply content. There are vast areas of Torah that no person would regard as not being Torah that are just not part of the curriculum of traditional yeshiva study. I'll give you one example from my own family. I was speaking one day to a Jew who nowadays is called the Haredi Jew. When I grew up, that word meant religious when you spoke Hebrew. My father wrote for the Hadoar, and he wrote an article on the founding of Stern College, and it was a Hebrew article, and he wrote about how there was now a Michlala Levanot, it was a college for women, for Haredi Jews. And the term was used differently, but in any case, I was talking to this fellow who teaches Daf Yomi Shir. He's not a Rov, but he's certainly a serious Ben Torah. In the course of the conversation, I mentioned that the language of the Rambam's principles, I don't remember which one we were talking about in particular, but that the language of the Ramban's principles in the Siddur is not necessarily identical with the language that the Rambam himself wrote when he listed those principles in his introduction to Perek Chelek. And the reaction I got was actually startling. He had no idea that, A, that this was the case, B, it wasn't even clear to me, and I think it was clear the other way, that he knew where the Rambam had formulated those principles at all. So I showed it to him. We were in a room that had a Gemara. You could open up a regular, Shas, the Sanhedrin, and turn to the back, and you can find it. His reaction to this was something like, "How do you know this?" Or "Where do you know this from?" Or something like that. Which is a rather sharp illustration of the fact that that the scope of what is studied is much more limited than the scope of Torah by any definition of Torah. The scope of what is studied in traditional yeshiva environments is much more limited than that. You can supply many other examples of what I have in mind, whether it's parshanut beyond Rashi and to some degree Ramban on the Torah, and many other areas, the works of Machshava, and so on. Then there is the question of the... So there's no question that studying this material, which in the real world comes almost exclusively, I say almost, in academic environments, enriches one's knowledge of Torah and supplies perspectives that will have an effect on one's understanding of other areas of Torah as well. Then there are the questions of approach or of methodology that have aroused and continue to arouse significant controversy. It's difficult to discuss this subject without touching on areas of controversy. One example is one that Rabbi J.J. Schachter addressed in a very long article years ago in the Torah Mada Journal on the question of historical honesty. He addressed a comment that became that was widely discussed for a little while by Rabbi Schwab, who had said that the study of Gedolei Yisrael, the biographies of Gedolei Yisrael, should not take place using the usual canons of historical inquiry, because although these people certainly did have some flaws, it is counterproductive educationally to point to those flaws. And therefore, while full historical honesty in studying biographies is appropriate in all other areas, it is not appropriate in this area. Now, whatever one feels about the propriety of this position in itself, it has consequences that are worth considering in terms of one's understanding of Judaism. Because one has to define what a flaw is. A flaw is in the eyes of the beholder sometimes. There are certain imperfections that everybody would understand are imperfections. You know, so-and-so lost his temper. Or even there, sometimes it's not, may not be a flaw, though usually it's a flaw. But what about so-and-so read newspapers? Or so-and-so had a positive attitude toward Maskili. Now, these are real examples. Is that a flaw or not a flaw? Once you think it is a flaw, then you take the position that flaws should be effectively suppressed, then you have a situation in which Gedolim are presented in ways different from what they really were. And then, and this is the most significant point, and then they come to be used as models for the way of life that you have constructed by rewriting their biographies. In this context, I once pointed to a favorite line of mine from Yechezkel Kaufman, not an Orthodox Jew, but someone who was opposed to certain extreme forms of biblical criticism, in which he was commenting on the penchant of Bible critics, even more so in his day than today, to rewrite biblical texts, correct verses. And he wrote in one place that typical Bible critics, trying to remember, the language was roughly like this: Kotvim umechaberim psukim b'mo yedehem, v'achar kach chozrim umotzeim bahem kol ma shehichnisu letocham. Which means that they compose verses with their own hands, and then go back and find in them, in those verses, everything that they put into them. Here he was talking about biblical studies. But in a very serious sense, this problem confronts us in a case like this, where rabbinic figures, after their views have in effect been rewritten, become models for an ideology that rejects the views that their real behavior might have legitimated. And this brings us, or is connected, to the question of Das Torah, which I don't want to discuss in detail here. There is much discussion about this issue. It is in very important ways a historical question. That is, what was the authority of rabbis in Jewish communities through the ages? Reasonable people can reach different conclusions about this matter. A person seriously studying the role of rabbinic authority throughout Jewish history may well conclude that the authority of rabbis was closer to the one that the Aguda endorses than it is to the one that the modern Orthodox Jews generally follow. It's by no means guaranteed that a careful study of this question historically will lead to the conclusions most congenial to the sorts of people who engage in academic Jewish studies. But what is clear is that one cannot study and engage such a question without a historical dimension, and that means without studying Jewish history seriously. Now, this issue is also connected with the evaluation of Torah Umada itself, that is, the legitimacy of secular learning, however one defines Torah Umada. On this issue, there was quite some years ago, back in 1994, an exchange in which a distinguished figure in the Aguda, and since I'm being critical of this line, I don't think there's any purpose in naming names, wrote the following in response to a letter that was in turn responding to a review of Dr. Lamb's book, Torah Umada. Here is the assertion. I won't redo the whole thing. The assertion is that Torah Umada advocates, in effect, even if not rhetorically, place Mada on an equal level, at least to Torah. There may be an uncomfortable degree of truth in this. And the author then goes on to say the following: the attempts that were made in past Jewish history, in medieval Spain and in 19th century Germany, to accommodate Torah life with the culture of the times, were aimed at precisely that, accommodation, not sanctification. Mada and the pursuit of secular wisdom is never, in any Torah viewpoint, accorded the status of even a quasi-religious imperative. The mitzvah of a Dibarta Bam and Ba'agisa Bam and the entire thrust of Jewish soul commitment is directed exclusively at Torah study, as forever understood, completely opposed to the idea of Torah Umada. Hence our strong rejection of a philosophy that is a radical departure from the tenets and traditions of the Yadus. Now, the assertion that the study of secular wisdom was never accorded the status of even a quasi-religious imperative in all of Jewish history reminded me immediately of the title of an article that was written by Herbert Davidson, a professor of medieval Jewish philosophy, lives in Los Angeles, and is an observant Jew himself, called The Study of Philosophy as a Religious Obligation. It happens that the book that was edited by Rabbi Schachter, in which there are long, almost book-length essays by Gerald Blitzstein about Chazal, and by me about medieval and early modern times, and by Schneider Lyman about the modern period, and by Rav Aaron Lichtenstein approaching the issue as a matter of hashkafa, was written in part to address this sort of point historically. When that book came out, I actually sent the author of the paragraph that I just read you a copy of my section of this, which is really a historical discussion of these issues in the Middle Ages. I got a very nice response without a full concession, but actually, if you read it carefully, there was a bit of a concession. In any case, that's an example where the study of Jewish history is central to how one forms the parameters of what is acceptable or not acceptable in traditional Judaism. I'm going to give you a few more examples what I think are very important issues in the Jewish religion. One or two of them halachic, or without being too specific except in one case, and the others are dealing with what we usually call hashkafa, where the academic study of Judaism plays an important role in formulating one's views without necessarily prejudging what the result will be. But you can't reach a conclusion in a way that really involves full intellectual integrity and loyalty to Jewish tradition itself, without this mode, or at least without these parameters of study. So here are some examples. What are the parameters that Judaism allows with respect to Agadah? Is one obligated to believe Agadot literally? May one take Agadot non-literally, but still be bound by the position that they are always true? Is there a leeway to say that some Agadot may be the opinions of rabbis that are not necessarily part of binding tradition and could therefore be rejected? These are issues that impinge on one's understanding of Judaism in profound ways. There's no question that the position that one takes on an issue like this has profound consequences in how one forms one's own Jewish worldview. It arose repeatedly and centrally during the controversy over the works of the Rambam, which is something that is studied in academic Jewish history context. It's not studied anywhere else. Nobody in a yeshiva environment proper studies the letters that were written in the course of the Maimonidean controversy. It's just not part of the curriculum. Position of the Ramban with respect to Agadah is known to the best people in the yeshiva world who never took a college course. He formulates it in his disputation, which is read not in yeshiva shiurim, but people with any sort of intellectual bent in the yeshiva world are familiar with that text. So that the Ramban said this is generally known. How to evaluate it is complicated, and the subject of much academic discussion, some of which I don't think is very good. The last thing I'm trying to argue is that every piece of academic Jewish scholarship is correct or even worthwhile. But that's the human condition. But awareness of the parameters of this question comes from pursuing Jewish studies in a broader context. Of course, this issue came to the fore in the context of the Slifkin affair, where it was not just the literal understanding of the first chapter of Bereishit that was at stake, but also the question of the authority of the literal understanding, or really even in general, the authority of Chazal with regard to scientific matters. Another issue that already did come up in the Middle Ages, and where the discourse on this question was, in some circles anyway, limited by a lack of connectedness to sources that are usually not studied in yeshivas proper. Another issue of Hashgafa that I would just touch upon, but since the minhag in Kol El Yom Rishon and Midrashet is to look at a Jewish text occasionally, and I don't want to be accused of talking about academic Jewish studies and proving that it has nothing to do with Torah by never looking at a Torah text. So I asked that these quotations from the Ramban, Al HaTorah and Al Iyov, be reproduced. I thanks to Halpern for doing this At the last minute, I didn't really decide that I should do this until the last minute. And I just want to look at a few texts, not to discuss the resolution of the issue, but to indicate how a very important question can be discussed simplistically if people know only one source, the most commonly cited one, and don't know other less commonly cited sources. Now, on this point, I had a personal experience that was a little bit disconcerting. On reflection, I don't know how much I can blame the person who said what he did. I was sitting at a bris in the Bostoner Shul Shtiebel in Brooklyn. And it was the meal after the bris, and there were tables set up with benches on each side that were right up against the back of the bench facing the other table. So if you were sitting in the middle, you couldn't move. You were completely in prison. I was sitting in the middle of one of the benches, and a person sitting across the across from me, who was a relative who also had was also an academic, asked me that terrible question, the question that forces full professors with tenure to continue to do research. He said, I hate even to say the words, he said, "What are you working on?" So I told him that I was writing an article arguing that the Ramban really did believe in the existence of a natural order, despite a famous quotation or two in which he says that there is no such thing as nature. And that's all I said. I didn't elaborate anything. And there was someone sitting at the end of the bench that I was sitting on, whom I didn't know, separated from me by a few people, who leaned over and said, "This is what happens when you go to college. You distort the words of the Rishonim. The Masalef, the words of the Rishonim. The Ramban didn't believe in nature. You're not allowed to believe in nature. Essentially, anyone who believes in the existence of nature is a heretic." And he cited that, you know, Donald Kefetz Bo Milamata, Lemin Pen Rachwizin Olav Milamala, which is not really on point. I told him, "Look, you know, I'm stuck in the middle of this bench. But you're sitting right next to a bookcase which happens to have the Perush Ramban, Chevelle's edition of the Perush Ramban HaTorah in it. And you don't even have to, he wouldn't have had to get up. He would have just had to extend his left hand, take it. And I told him, you know, take out the Ramban and Breshis. And I'll show you a passage that makes me think what I think. And we can talk about it." And he refused to take the book down, because if he would take the book down, and, you know, on reflection, this is not, I was upset about it, but it's not, in a certain sense, completely crazy. The point was that if he takes the book down, he is conceding that there's a possibility that the Ramban holds a view that he has been taught his heresy. It's forbidden to suggest that the Ramban may have been a heretic. It's not, you know, there is this tendency, of course, to laugh about this. And I thought about the famous story of the person who wouldn't look through Galileo's telescope because if there were moons around Jupiter, that would be heresy. But it's not. I actually understand the position. But it is a reflection of the problems that arise when certain views come to be seen as the only acceptable Jewish view, and that this arises in part because of a certain constriction of the scope of what within Torah people actually study. So I just want to illustrate the different formulations of the Ramban. Without talking about how it might or may not be resolvable. There's one line in the longest passage you have here, which is the line that serves as the foundation for the view that the Ramban denied nature. And it's not strange that it should serve as the foundation for such a view, because that's what the words say. If you look at the last paragraph of the long quotation, the one that begins on the back page of this, from the great evident miracles, a person comes to accept the hidden miracles that are the basis of the entire Torah. Shein adam chelik b'saras Moshe Rabbeinu asher na'amin b'chol dvareinu u'mikreinu shekulam nisim ein bohem teva u'mihago shel olam b'ein b'rabim b'ein b'yachid. A person has no portion in the Torah of Moshe until we believe that all our, I'll use the vague word that he uses, all our things and events, they're all miracles. They do not involve nature and the way of the world, whether for groups or for individuals. Elohim yasa mitzvos yasnichem uscharo. If you observe the mitzvos, you are rewarded. V'im yagor lehem yachisen won't show. If you violate them, you will be punished. Hakol b'zeiras elyon kasher yizkar tifar. That's the famous, I mean, it's not the only place where the Ramban says this. He says it in another two, three places. So then we look at the passage in Bereishit, which is what I asked him to take off the shelf. This is also the Perashat Torah. This is something that is studied outside of academic Jewish studies, but this passage is less impressive than the other one. What does it mean when God says regarding Avraham that I know him, I love him, whatever it is, I know him, l'man hashay yitzaveh, etc. Let's go to the seventh line. The sixth line. Yirmoz, middle of the sixth line, ki yidias Hashem, God's knowledge, shehi hashgacha sol ba'olam hashafel, which is his providence over the lower world, hi lishmar ha'klolim, God watches over species, whatever, or general matters, entities. V'gam b'nei adam ha'munachim bo l'mikrim, I'm sorry, not ha'munachim, v'gam b'nei adam munachim bo l'mikrim, and even human beings are left to accidents. Ad bo es pekudasam, until the time comes for them to be judged, let's say. Avo b'chasidav, with respect to exceptionally pious people, yosume lov libo ladaso so bifrat, God pays attention to him to know him in detail, v'yos shmiroso devekobo tamid, so that God's protection will be constantly connected to him. Lo tipored hayidiova hazichiva mimenu kla. This is appears to say that not all people are protected by constant or are even touched by constant miraculous events. If you look at the Perush on Iyov, which is on the back page in the little Rashi script, I won't come anywhere near reading the whole thing because there are other things I want to discuss. What we have here is a passage that is largely a paraphrase of the Moran of Ruchi. He says that the highly righteous people are protected. And then we go to the first line, at the end of the first line of the second column. V'horochok min hakel, v'machshavto v'masav, a person who is far from God in his thought and his actions. V'afim lo yischayev misa b'chet o asher chata, even if he is not deserving of death for this sin, he will be left to accidents, which indicate that it is only the specially righteous who are protected. And a bit later on, line, talking out of that column, line eight. Umipnei sherov ha'olam min hakat or hakas hazos ha'emtzois. Most of the world is in this middle category. That is, they're not tremendous tzaddikim, and they also don't deserve to be killed right away. because of that, the Torah required wars to be fought in certain ways and so on. This is a case where the worldview of the Ramban is complicated by the study of material that goes beyond the most evident passages that come to people's attention. Now, I said that I would say a little bit about halachic issues as well. I'll give you a few examples. This is less clear cut because halacha is studied with great seriousness by halachists, and you're not going to have a situation in which, usually, in which there are things they don't know because they haven't studied them. What halachists know about halacha is a lot more than what historians and academics know about halacha, with virtually no exceptions, I'm afraid. Here we're talking about not knowledge. I'll give you one example where knowledge is relevant to this discourse, but methodology or approach. One of the issues, or at least that awareness of the question can enrich one's understanding of something. I don't like this word at all. I don't think it existed when I was young. The halachic process. But I guess there is such a thing. In Hebrew we now have the word psika rather than psak to represent this idea. One of the significant areas of contention between Orthodoxy and conservative Judaism especially is the argument that conservative Jews make that poskim changed their psak over the years because of historical considerations, and that we therefore should do the same. This is a nuanced matter. On the whole, I believe that poskim knew what they were doing through the ages. They were not sort of fooling themselves into thinking that a certain psak is okay because they were being motivated by historical forces that they didn't recognize. I don't think that that is true, or that is generally true. However, the question of the interaction between economic issues, between ideological issues, and psak halacha is an important, intriguing, and fascinating enterprise, whether it deals with the kinds of issues Chaim Soloveitchik has studied with regards to wine and interest, whether it deals with how poskim paskin with respect to the heter mechira regarding Shemitah, and a host of other issues. These are matters where the study of the history, or at least historically informed study of the history of psak, I think, and we can't talk about details now, I think it produces insights that are valuable and that you don't really get in another way. I'll give you a sensitive, final, concrete example, which has to do with the Jewishness of Ethiopian Jews, a very sensitive and controversial and concrete example. And it's one that also indicates that the conclusions that emerge out of historical study are not necessarily the conclusions that the people who study history, who tend, for whatever reasons, to have more liberal religious orientations, not necessarily the conclusions that they want. The study of history can lead to unwanted conclusions if the study is carried out honestly. The requirement that Ethiopian Jews undergo a tevila as part of a kind of biur l'chumra, was the position of some very important poskim, including Moshe Feinstein, and some Israeli poskim as well. This became a politically sensitive issue, as you know. Many Ethiopian Jews became more and more opposed to having to do this because they were told, you know, by non-religious Jews in Israel that they were being insulted. But whatever brought this about, and I don't want to say that they were just being manipulated. Obviously, this is something that emerged from within as well. And Rav Avadia Yosef famously ruled that they are Jewish, require no gear whatsoever, because the Radbaz and another important authority in that period said that they were from the tribe of Dan, and they would not have said this unless they knew. He even raises the point that some academic types say otherwise. But he said there was no way for them to be sure. Consequently, there is absolutely no basis for overturning the position of the Radbaz. Now, this has very salutary social effects, this psak, obviously. Somebody who was interested in the unity of Israeli society and the elimination of discord will embrace this psak emotionally. But from a historical perspective, it's pretty much not sustainable. So the question is, what does one do in a case like this? Does one say that that the halachic process has its own rules, those rules operate based on the majority opinion of poskim, and precedent that can be found in works of Psa. It doesn't matter what historians think they pretty much know. Or does one say that one who believes in the relevance of other disciplines to Judaism in general should also reject the position that history is irrelevant when reaching halachic decisions, even when they are unpalatable. There are other examples of this sort, although this is one of the most striking that I can think of. And it illustrates, as I said earlier, that there are emotional tensions involved in taking positions that one must look at academic disciplines making Jewish decisions having to do with Judaism. As in the case of the Ramban, and miracles, this is not an issue that I want to pursue in detail now, it's worth, I think, complicating the emotional element in this discourse so that people don't engage in a kind of modern Orthodox triumphalism, because you realize that you don't always want to act on these convictions. And so let me conclude. Everyone makes mistakes in assessing historical evidence. People will differ in applying the lessons of history to public policy and to halakha. What is inadmissible, I think, is to oppose the study of history and other fields of academic scholarship at a sophisticated level, and then invoke history to prove a point. But everyone invokes history to prove points. You can very rarely prove points without invoking history. Intellectual history, after all, is also history. The conclusion, then, I think, is hard to avoid. The sophisticated study of history, and to some degree other academic areas as well, is an imperative for an informed and intellectually honest discourse about the most fundamental beliefs and decisions that engage religious jury today, no matter what the final conclusions that kind of study will reach might be. You wanted to make there was supposed to be an advertisement about some tour. Is that going to happen?
No, I don't know.
Okay,
thank you very much, Berger. The next session will start momentarily.